You know, I could not be luckier than today having with me here an incredibly wonderful four scholars that have a very deep background as far as religion is concerned, and particularly how it is manifesting itself in the Middle East in connection with the rise of Islamic extremism, with the Israeli-Palestinian, the dimension of the Israeli-Palestinian religious conflict. So what we're trying to do today is basically try to initially just have a little short overview of the Islamic radicalism, but the focus is going to be on the psychological dimension of the religious conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. Because I take the position that unless Israelis and the Palestinians begin to change their narratives in that regard and begin to understand that there is religious implications to their conflict and begin to engage in a different kind of narrative and understand that that conflict needs to be settled in one form or another, and how it is translated when dealing with the future of Jerusalem, then this conflict is going to continue not for decades to come. And so, without further ado, let me just very briefly introduce my guest here. Patrick, on my right here. Patrick has a long, exciting career in the American Foreign Service. He has put, east of whatever I'm saying here. As you put it, east of Suez, saw him actively involved in the majority of major American engagement in the region, varying from Somalia to Lebanon to Jordan and elsewhere. His strong personal and professional ties to the Greek Orthodox Patriarch in Jerusalem gives him a special perspective for the topic we have discussion today. Rabbi Charles Feinberg. Charles Feinberg has been a rabbi at Adas Israel Congregation in Washington for the last 9 years. This summer, he will become the executive director of the Interfaith Action of Human Rights. Rabbi Feinberg has also served on the board and the co-chairperson of the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. On my left, the distinguished, and I'm delighted to tell you I've known Clark for some time, and so happy to have him here as well. Ronan Clark is the Executive Director of the Churches of Middle East Peace, a coalition of national church groups that conduct advocacy and education in support of an end of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Ambassador Clark was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Africa and served in the United States Foreign Service in the Middle East, Africa, Europe, Canada, and the United Nations in New York. He holds 4 graduate degrees, including from Virginia Technological Seminary.
Theological,
yes, sir. And then we have a very, very distinguished Islamic scholar, that is Jonathan Brown, sitting there on my other left side. He is the Al-Walid bin Talal Chair of Islamic Civilization School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Dr. Brown has studied and is educated and conducted research in Egypt, Syria, Turkey, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, South Africa, India, Indonesia, and Iran. He has published articles in the fields of faith, Islamic law, Salafism, Sufism, Arabic lexical theory, and pre-Islamic poetry, and is the author and the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Law. I don't think we could have possibly have gotten much more qualified panel like that we have today, and I'm sure that the discussion we're going to have is going to be extremely enlightening, and hopefully we're going to come up with a solution today, how we are going to resolve the religious dimension, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. So let me begin with you, Jonathan Brown. Perhaps you can give us just a minute or two your take on what the subject matter that we're trying to discuss today, to put things in the proper perspective, and we just take it from there.
I'll start by saying I really hope that I wasn't going to be asked to speak first. So my
prayers weren't answered in this regard.
I'll represent the Arab / Islamic perspective here. I actually think it's not a religious issue, and I think this is. This gets bandied about a lot when we talk about the Israel-Palestine issue. Is it religious? Is it national or land issue, resource distribution? I think if you look at the history of the Arab response to Jewish immigration and settlement in what became Israel-Palestine, that the initial opposition is actually from Christian Palestinians who are, they have more journals, they have more newspapers, they're more educated, and really that the opposition is both Christian and Muslim from that point on, really from the 19-teens and 1920s onward until today. And that some of the most ecumenical statements made by Muslim scholars are made by, Mufti Amin al-Husseini, who, if you look at, for example, the Nusayris, the Alawites in Syria, which Bashar al-Assad is one, ruling minority in Syria. There are almost no fatwas by Muslim scholars saying that they are Muslims. Amin al-Husseini's fatwa is one of the very few religious, opinions, qualified religious opinions, that in fact the Alawites are Muslim. Why is he saying that? Because he is eager, and he's eager to create the biggest possible camp, the biggest possible tent, to oppose what he saw as sort of Zionist settlement in Palestine. So I think that you see, and if you look at the groups that work together through under the umbrella of the PLO from the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, I mean, you have Marxist groups, you have communist groups, socialist groups, atheist groups, working with Hamas, working with Islamic Jihad. Islamic Jihad is a very, very religiously committed group. But they are happy to work with Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine. They're happy to work with atheist Palestinians. They're happy to work with Christian Palestinians. So you see a certain amount of internecine or intra-Palestinian strife, but it really doesn't often break down along ideological lines or religious lines. It's often over, let's say, who has access to the international teat of money, or for example, who's the one who's been selected as the group who's going to receive international funding and then distribute it, as opposed to who's going to threaten that monopoly of control over the Palestinian territories. So I think that there is certainly a religious element to that Arab/Muslim response to Zionism and Israel. But I think that is a cosmetic element a lot of the time. That's how things are dressed up. And that doesn't mean that it's not important. It doesn't mean that a Hamas fighter or an Islamic Jihad fighter doesn't really believe what they're doing is jihad in the path of God. I don't doubt that they really believe that. That's a very strong motivation. But the fact of the matter is, 10 years earlier, 20 years earlier, someone was doing the exact same thing, and they were socialist or they were a communist. And two doors down, there's somebody doing the exact same thing, and they're a socialist or they're a communist or they're an atheist or they're a Christian. And so I think that's very important. And if you could just erase religion from the minds of Palestinians, they would still have all the problems that they have now. The problem would not be resolved. I don't want to take up too much time. I don't want to say that it's not a religious issue, because I think it very clearly is, especially from the Jewish and the Christian perspective. But I think actually from the Arab/Muslim perspective, it's not so much.
Well, let me just say, that is, if you suggest that if you are to resolve other issues between the Israelis and the Palestinians, then the religious dimension will also be resolved. Is that what you are suggesting?
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, definitely. I think the religion, to talk about a Marxist framework, I mean, I think here the religion is the superstructure and the unresolved issues of control and disenfranchisement and land and power and and rights. These are the real issues.
So let me ask Charles to take it from there.
No, I would. I think it is more an ethnic conflict than a religious conflict, I have note. And if you look at the Jewish community, it is, only a certain percentage of the Jewish community views itself as religious in the land of Israel. Maybe 25%, maybe 30% tops. Israelis pride themselves on being secular. And so the conflict is more nationalistic and ethnic than religious. That being said, so what happens is that I often think about the conflict is gets so difficult because each community is divided on some of these issues as well. That is, it's not like the Jewish community, the Palestinians said, okay, we're going to deal, That would create all kinds of havoc within the Jewish community, the Israeli community, because there's a great division there. And in the there are strong elements in the religious community who would definitely compromise with the Palestinians. And there are strong elements in the secular community that would not. They're much more nationalistic and who believe more strongly that the Jewish people have a right to the land from the Jordan to the Mediterranean. And there's no debating that, right? Whereas in the religious community, especially in the ultra-Orthodox community, there are many groups that would not say that. So they would be willing to compromise more on territory if indeed there was a real chance to make peace. So it's complicated in that sense. The other thing I would say is that when each side denies each other's narrative, that's when that really pushes the buttons of each side. So when Palestinians say that the Temple Mount would never had a temple on it and that it was never the center of Jewish life in the land of Israel, that drives Jews up the wall, totally up the wall, because it's such an important part of our ethos and how we imagine our relationship to the land of Israel. And when we do it to the Palestinians and deny their peoplehood, etc., that drives them up the wall as well. And I think that's another element that makes the conflict so difficult.
And take it from there.
I'm generally in agreement that the conflict is largely political, that a lot of people who were once Bolsheviks and communists have taken over the religion, and this applies to all sides. I have very strong views on the historical subject. There's this joke that says that war is far too important to be left to the generals. Religion is far too important to be left to the religious leaders. We need the history of the Middle East in terms of religious conflict. Until the 20th century was largely a history, when I'm talking about the Byzantine Empire and later the Ottoman Empire, was later a history of the political component running the religions, not the religious component. The Byzantine emperor, who was a secular man, was the one who called all the ecumenical councils. He fired patriarchs, hired patriarchs, and pretty much made sure that the church was there to serve the needs. It was the handmaiden of the emperor. It was there to serve the needs of the people. The caliphate. I doubt there was ever an Ottoman sultan who could remotely be regarded as a religious scholar. They ran the religion in the interests of the state. Collapse, the final collapse of the empires, the transition to 20th century statehood and so forth, created civilian governments, created secular governments throughout the region that frankly were inept, decadent, oppressive. The best of them were not governments that truly had the interests of their populations at hand. And I've heard Israelis say the same thing about aspects of the Israeli government as well, that these are governments that are there that are self-serving and self-preserving. They have opened the field to political operatives who have decided that the old philosophies don't work. Now they're going to pick the political philosophies of the 20th century, the modern ones. It is easier to appeal to someone's identity as a Muslim, as a Christian, or as a Jew, than it is to really come up with governing.
It would take it from there, then.
Thank you. I might just talk briefly about the religious aspect of this. I agree with the other speakers that we're talking really about a national and ethnic conflict. But there are, I mean, Jerusalem is the center of three faiths. On the Christian side, there are 13 heads of churches and patriarchs. There is a council, an interfaith council of Jewish leaders, Christian leaders, and Muslim leaders. Incidentally, they're all paid by the governments. They're government employees. And so what they say, what they agree upon, really is conditioned very much by what their government will allow them to say. But even so, there's a lot of agreement between them. And the issue really is not between the religious leaders themselves. It's between these other groups, these extreme right or left groups on both sides that are driving the politics. The religious leaders themselves are agreed that each of the three faiths, has deep roots and deep interests in the old city of Jerusalem. They all recognize that. They all recognize that they have holy places that must be respected. I think they also agree among them that the only thing to do right now is to hold on to the status quo. That one of the worst things you could do is try to change who's in charge of which holy place. Try to change what's happening on the Temple Mount, or Harim HaRashif, or the other holy places. There was a crisis last fall when some Knesset members wanted to go up, perhaps conduct prayers and do other things on the Temple Mount. There was people get killed. I mean, people die in these situations. There was an attempted assassination. Other people were killed shortly after. Jordan broke up diplomatic relations. Incidentally, on the Temple Mount, the Harim HaSharif, in the view of some, that's under really Jordanian administration, under the peace treaty between Israel and Jordan. The king of Jordan is in charge of the holy places. Because they're so sensitive, they didn't want to give it to one political group or another. And so they have retained that. And when there was this problem last fall, Jordan withdrew its ambassador from Jerusalem. That's now been restored. So the problem is not so much the religious leaders themselves as the political groups that drive the various governments. Prime Minister Netanyahu himself talks about, does not talk really in religious terms. He talks in ethnic terms. He talks about how Jewish people have been there for 3,000 years. He talks about a recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. By that, I think he's talking about an ethnicity, not a religious state. He talks about Jerusalem as the eternal capital of Israel. I'm not sure what that means, but it's a very broad, kind of fuzzy idea that has an enormous amount of emotional appeal. And then, of course, one would have to ask when he says that, what does he mean by Jerusalem? Because there are many different Jerusalems. There's the old city, there's the borders of 1967, there are the borders that were extended after 1967, all those issues remain unresolved.
Those are political. The
boundaries of Jerusalem may well be political, but when Netanyahu speaks about Jerusalem, he speaks about East and West Jerusalem. You know, we can pretty much now at this point, you know, exactly define the parameters of Greater Jerusalem. But this is exactly what he means. He also suggests that the city of Jerusalem is mentioned in the Old Testament 700 times in various names. So the question, you know, there's no doubt in my mind, in any event, that Jerusalem and how to resolve the future of Jerusalem has very serious religious implications. And let us try to focus just on that for a moment and see. Let me raise the question in that regard and suggest, can we, in fact, would there be a possibility of reaching an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, unless there is an agreement on the future of Jerusalem itself? And what kind of a solution that can be accepted to both sides in connection with Jerusalem in order to really be able to fashion a peace agreement between the two sides? Let me go back to Jonathan on this point.
I entirely agree. I mean, I think that the status of Jerusalem is absolutely crucial in a way because I think it stands for a lot of other things. And I think one of the you know, I guess there's a lot of different opinions about what to do, but I'll just give you my own opinion. But, one of the problems is that we, let's say the United States or, you know, generally in Western capitals, there's a sort of an allergy to the idea of religious discrimination, justifiably, right? So in the United States, we wouldn't want to have a certain part of Washington, D.C. be the Jewish part, and a certain part of Washington be the Christian part, right? But I think in a place like Jerusalem, and if you know, you were to have a really democratic, just state, whether it's called Israel or Palestine or whatever, in that state, I think there would be a tremendous amount of separation, and I think that that would be for everybody's. I think that, if you have communities that define themselves confessionally, and where confessional religious identity is extremely important, and where there are certain physical locations that are crucial to those identities, it's important to recognize that and not to say, well, it's freedom of religion, so why not let Jews go pray on the Temple Mount? Yeah, that makes sense. You know, let's say an urban American reader, but that's absolutely disastrous when you think about what that means for the people involved, let's say for the Palestinian Muslims, for the Palestinian Christians, if a Jew is allowed to go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and just start praying there as well. But I think that part of it is maybe, I would say, we need to accept that the future may have to be a very divided city under some kind of international or external control, let's just say external control, and that those dividing lines are not necessarily bad, that we can't allow our allergy or our suspicion or dislike for religious discrimination, religious line drawing, to prevent us from seeing when that can be very useful.
You know, I don't know, I have to take an issue with that with you on this matter, because if you were in Jerusalem, visiting Jerusalem in the 80s, you would see that, and I used to call it then, this is a microcosm, how the future of Israel and the Palestinians get together. So there's going to be no division, only perhaps in the map, that you can see separation between the two sides, but you can, under no circumstances, in my view, also from a political perspective, you can create that kind of divide between the two sides. Be that as it may, let me go to Clark and take it from there.
The Jerusalem de facto is divided now. I mean, you walk through the city, you know exactly if you're in East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem. It looks different, the people are different. I'm told, someone who's recognizable as a Jew gets stones thrown at him sometimes he's walking in the streets of East Jerusalem. It's a very de facto divided city. The city there have been many proposals for what to do about Jerusalem, so going back to the corpus separatum from before the Second World War. President Clinton had parameters he announced in the year 2000, in which the Jewish part would remain part of Israel and the Palestinian part would remain a part of the Palestinian state. We are told that when people came, there were some various proposals were made in 2008, when there were negotiations that had never been completely revealed, but it sounds though they were the politicians were talking about it. So the politicians themselves have at various times, not recently, but in the past, have themselves come up with ways of dealing with Jerusalem. They've always, however, been I think, very afraid of ratifying any kind of agreement, unless it was a package deal that included almost everything under the sun. But interestingly, I don't think the religious leaders were consulted much on that. This was a political deal, the religious people were there, but they were not part of the consultation. When you talk to religious leaders, they want very much to be part of the conversation, because access to holy places, the ability to move around the city, who is in charge of which place, is terribly important to them. And I think they're in a position to create problems if they're not brought in, if they're not consulted. But ultimately, it's going to be a political decision. But I think I differ here with some people on this table. I don't think it's an impossible problem. I think it's possible to deal with.
So let us talk a little bit about these possibilities. Would you like to take it from that point?
Thanks.
I'm pretty developer.
part of the problem that I have seen is that the official religious leaders are frequently not the people really in charge of their group, of their sect, of their people. I was present once in a conversation between the Mufti of Jerusalem and the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, and in which the Mufti said to the chief rabbi, he said, you know, if you and I could agree on how to split the Haram Sharif, the Temple Mount, the rest of the country, the rest of the politicians would have no choice but to go along with us. And the Ashkenazi chief rabbi essentially replied, yeah, but which one of us, it's a little bit like belling the cat, which one of us has the courage to actually go ahead and say that we agree? So I think there has been a loss of authority by the traditional religious leaders. I agree that there has to be a single city. Nothing else is feasible at this time. But then this raises a new question of, should there be a single state? Or, you know, are we really fooling ourselves into thinking that a single city in a two-state solution is viable? I do believe that there has to be a larger dialogue, and that the larger dialogue has to include outside powers that have an interest in the city.
Well, from the Jewish perspective, religious leaders in the Jewish community in Israel are not respected. They're respected by their own small groups that they lead, but they're ferociously attacked by both the other religious leaders and the secular community says a pox on all their houses and can't stand. So there was no religious leader in Israel who would have the standing and the authority to do the kind of deal that you mentioned. They would just be either ignored or laughed at or viciously attacked. We can't even agree about standards of conversion into Judaism, let alone how Jerusalem should be set up. So that's what I think. The conflicts within the communities themselves have a big, great bearing on what happens with the conflict with the Palestinians and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I think that's one. One other thing, just about where people should live. I was in Israel a couple of years ago, and there was a big discussion in the press and the radio. Israel has a series of settlements that were throughout the land. They were originally set up as agricultural settlements. And some of them basically have become fairly upper middle class, and they're no longer agricultural settlements. They're suburbs. They're nice, very nice gated communities, basically. I guess that's how we would call them. And so Israeli Arabs wanted to live in some middle class Israeli Arabs who had the resources to buy a home in one of these. So those, and these were kind of
cheaper
than in one of closed communities. And so the question was, could they live there? And, you know, was it legal for them to live there? And so even within the state of Israel, this is a very controversial issue and goes to the heart of how the conflict is so ethnic. Because do we want to have Arabs as our neighbors, basically? Arabs might say, do we want Jews as our neighbors? And I think Jonathan is right. There needs to be separate areas. It seems to me that's the only way it's going to work.
Let me just as a question, I could take it from there. You know, I think when you look at Jerusalem today, there's certain facts on the ground. And we have to recognize these facts on the ground, that I don't think any force, either from within or outside Israel and Palestinian territories, can change. You have nearly more than 250,000 Palestinians living mostly in East Jerusalem. You have about 450,000 Israeli Jews living both in east and west of Jerusalem. I don't believe that under any circumstances, you can in fact uproot either Israelis or Palestinians from their current places of residence. So this is a fact. I mean, from a political perspective, I don't see a government in Israel will be able to do so, or a Palestinian government will be agreed to anything to the contrary. So the question is today then, if this is a fact, A, do you accept that this is a fact that's irreversible? And if so, how do you go about creating a two-state? And I agree, and I don't think that two-state and have one capital is are mutually exclusive. I think you can have two independent states and still have a capital shared by the two people. And that's, I just wanted to address this issue.
But I think the issue that I'm very familiar with in Jerusalem is encroachment. And the fact that the Palestinians feel that Jews are encroaching in their neighborhoods and trying to buy their homes and or to dispossess them of their homes. And that's been a huge issue in East Jerusalem. So just the maintenance of the present structure and neighborhood structure is in conflict now, too.
If I could add, in terms of the divisions within the faith as well, I don't know the exact number, but a very significant number of Jews who have made Aliyah from Russia are in fact Greek Orthodox Christians. They've seen them in the Church of Holy Sepulchre. The Patriarchate of Jerusalem suspects that the number of practicing, as opposed to a nominal, of practicing Greek Orthodox Christians, that there are more Jewish practicing Greek Orthodox Christians of Russian origin than there are Arab practicing Greek Orthodox Christians. And the irony, it's not a comedy, but the irony is that the vast majority of the practicing Greek Orthodox Russian Jews are members of Avigdor Lieberman's party.
Yeah, they identify with the Jewish community. Yeah. Who you identify with is the
Jewish community. I don't know. I agree that with minor tweaking, probably you might be able to, or just freezing current boundaries in place, you might be able to have a functioning single city. But again, this is a question that requires a responsible and mature political leadership, which I'm afraid is lacking in the region.
If I could just do one. It's at the bottom, then, is this way a religious issue, and the issue is, in what ways can you create some trust between these two communities? To me, that's the fundamental question. If you could create some trust so you would believe to take some risks as far as coming to some compromises, but at the moment, every time they come a little closer to maybe working something out, often it's derailed because of a radical act on either side, you know, a terrorist act or some other violent act, and that just throws the whole thing askew. But the fundamental religious spiritual issue is the extraordinary lack of trust, and the real challenge is how can that trust be built up in someone.
Well, this is an important point, but trust, however, cannot be just simply agreed upon. And what I think one of the prerequisites of developing trust is, first of all, the mutual acceptance or recognition each other right. So let's take it from there. Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just want to add a point that a separation doesn't mean hard and fast lines. I think, you know, like Holly Hahn talked about, you know, sort of cosmopolitan ideal of people mixing in an open environment, and I think that happens now and it will continue to happen. I think there's nothing going to be surprising or unnatural about a Jewish merchant selling to an Arab or an Arab buying from a Jewish merchant or a Jew and Arab living next to each other and having good neighborly relations. But I think that all depends on a notion that there are understood boundaries, like. A Jew can interact with an Arab if he knows that his place of worship is safe. A Muslim can interact with an Israeli if he knows that his place of worship or her place of worship is safe, right? If you know that your area is not going to be encroached upon, then it really, you don't mind having a Jewish neighbor because that doesn't mean anything. There's no looming political context around that. So I think a lot of, if there were a clear notion of stable boundaries and separations, I think that actually you probably find a cosmopolitan atmosphere as a product of that. And I think you know, in terms of building trust, this is a political issue in that it's about distribution of power and resources. Okay, one group has power, they have armed power, they have resources, they have international power, and another group does not. And until that imbalance is rectified in some way, there's not going to be a solution because nobody can ever in the United States, desegregation, which is a process which is absolutely not complete and still going on, has much more to have done in this country. But part of it is about white people saying, we're going to give up some of the power and privileges we've had. If that doesn't happen, you can't have a rectification or peaceful relations or solving an age-old conflict unless the party that is in power surrenders that until you have some kind of equitable distribution.
Yeah, I think the trick would be to get something that's more than one thing at the same time. There's a group that studies Jerusalem very closely called Iramim. They've got a website, they've got lots of maps. According to them, you could still, despite all the different neighborhoods that have been built up, you could still, if you really tried hard, draw a line that would separate East from West Jerusalem. But the area is so small that there's going to be interaction, there's going to be trade, there's going to be all kinds of things going on. But that there has to be, in this view, there has to be at some point a divorce that says, okay, this is my turf over here, that's your turf over there. We will respect these different areas.
You know, Jonathan mentioned, you know, you have a serious gap in terms of power, the exercise of power between Israel and the Palestinians. There's no question about it. And then you're suggesting that it has to be rectified by Israel making some kind of concession. Is that where you want to begin rectifying the imbalance between the two? And what kind of concession that will have religious implications to change? You know, there's no question that political settlement, that whether political settlement is a prerequisite to reaching an agreement on the differences, the religious differences between the two, or is it vice versa? From your perspective, how do you see that?
I would say that there is one other important factor that is as important as religion and as politics, and that is within the ability of the current Israeli government, or of an Israeli government, to actually build trust. And that is the question of the rule of law. The vast majority of Palestinians do not have confidence in the rule of law, whether it's Israeli courts or Israeli justice. I've dealt with the Patriarchate. By and large, we, the Patriarchate as an entity that has foreign protectors, has reasonable confidence in the Israeli court system. Far too many Palestinians have no confidence. I think a good way to start would be for the Israeli government to pull back from exploiting the court system for its own benefits, because you have very competent judges, you're very honest, you're really some very good people there. And I think that the first place to start would be by rebuilding confidence in the rule of law as neutral, as something that applies to everybody.
From the Palestinian point of view, they see the settlements as the biggest barrier to what creates the greatest lack of trust is to continue building the settlements. I heard once a prominent Israeli suggest that what really should happen is the Knesset should pass a bill saying they would buy out the settlers and resettle them, and that would be a strong signal then that indeed they were willing to meet many of the Palestinians' needs as far as land and settlement. But in the present environment, that seems like a very distant possibility.
You know, there's no doubt about the fact that many settlers, I don't want to say the majority, but certainly perhaps more than 50%, are in there because they can get better housing, subsidized housing, and are not there for religious reasons. There's one section. But there's also a group of settlers who are there for, because they believe that this is the land of Israel and that they have a religious duty to be there in order to repossess that particular land. So there's that, obviously the settlements play a significant role in aggravating the religious conflict between the two sides. So, you know, we mentioned a number of issues, question of competence, question of justice, question of trust. All of this is, of course, need to be addressed. The question then, who is going to address it? How should we go about beginning to address these issues, which are, without any doubt, they are an obstacle. They have been and will continue to be the hurdles. What is going to take? How do you begin, for example, to change the public narratives? in order to get to a point where we say, we need to, these things need to be changed. What kind of change? How do we go about it, Jonathan?
If I knew the answer to that, then I would also, I think, look at the United States, look at the political environment in the United States. It's a very similar problem. If you had, I think actually, not to arrogate to myself some role, but I think if we were in charge of this conflict, we could probably solve it right now. I think that the problem is that, and same thing, you could probably go grab five Americans off the street here, and some of them Republicans, some of the Democrats, and they could probably solve a lot of the problems that we have in the United States right now, whether it's healthcare, et cetera, right? So the problem is you have a deeply polarized political establishment in which the center, or let's just say moderate voices, are effectively useless and are excluded from what ends up being the final conversation. And I don't know how to solve that problem for this country or for any other country, so I actually have no idea how to proceed, so I'm sorry.
But then, I think you might have some ideas. You're saying you don't have any ideas, but I'm not prepared to submit to the reality, however complicated it may be. Because from my perspective, after 7 decades of horrible conflict between the two sides, will there be a day where we can say this conflict has to come to an end in a year or two, in 5 or 10, but it's going to have to come to an end because, again, I go back to certain realities on the ground. The Palestinian exists there. The Israelis cannot get rid of the Palestinians, period. Israel, the Palestinian cannot get rid of the Israelis, period. Now, I challenge anyone to show me how either side can get rid of the other. So if we accept this basic reality, which I've been advocating, now let's begin here to say, what is going to take to change that public narrative? Let's get a Jew, a rabbi, we have from the Greek Orthodox, we have a Christian, we have a Muslim. You say if we can sit together and discuss, so perhaps we can reach an agreement. Why don't we begin? What kind of process should we start in order to begin to change that narrative so that others will be listening there and come to the realization that there is no other choice? What do you do? How do you go about it?
Well, John Kerry thought he had a way of proceeding. He brokered these negotiations that went on from the end of 2013 until last spring, a year ago. I don't know quite why he thought he was going to be successful, because people were very skeptical from the beginning. But of course, they turned out very badly. And what happened was, by that time, you had a government in Israel that didn't seem very interested in negotiating and was going along kind of perhaps to humor U.S. Secretary of State. And there was the Palestinians by themselves had very firm positions. They weren't going to change much. So back about a year ago, December, the Secretary said, well, I have a framework, or I'll come up with a framework, and I'll announce a framework. And of course, everybody knows what the framework is, the 4 or 5 famous final status issues. And then people will start to negotiate based on these parameters. Somewhat like the way Clinton did in 2000. Well, Kerry found he couldn't come up with a framework because he was very much afraid that if he put forward a framework and if one of the sides accepted it, then there'd be huge pressure on the other side to accept it. But he couldn't get either side to accept it. There was a meeting at the White House a year ago, March of 2014. Abbas was there, and this is all off the record, and this is all unofficial, but they sort of said to him, look, here's some ideas, and what do you think? His answer was, he didn't have an answer. The story is, and these are all kind of rumors, that, there were some very severe problems. On both borders, we would have the borders based on the 1967 lines, taking into account Israeli security interests. Okay, what did that mean? That seems so broad that nobody could figure that out. The Jordan Valley was an Israeli security zone, and yes, they might make some adjustments, but there was no time frame. Absolutely no time frame as to when the Jordan Valley might eventually return to some kind of Palestinian sovereignty. Then there was Jerusalem, the subject we've been talking about. There was no agreement on Jerusalem. There was a rumor in the press that the idea of Beit Hanina had been raised. Beit Hanina is a little suburb of Jerusalem, about halfway between Jerusalem and Ramallah. It's kind of halfway from nowhere. It's miles and miles from the old city. And it was just totally unacceptable to the Palestinians to have a capital in Beit Hanina instead of in at least part of the East Jerusalem. So nobody got anywhere. Now, those of us who read the press on these things closely, there was an interesting item last week in the Jerusalem Post. It was published once, and then it disappeared. And Martin Indyk, who was, for a while, the U.S. negotiator for Palestinian-Israeli negotiations under Kerry, who has since left the State Department, is now Brookings. He was quoted as saying in the Jerusalem Post that we're coming up here on a turning point, on an important point in this history, which is the elections on March 17th. And we don't know how the elections are going to turn out. The polls show the Netanyahu's parties and the other parties of Herzog and Tzipi Livni are very close. Not all clear how it's going to come out. But that either way, no matter how the elections come out, Indyk was saying, the United States should make a proposal. The United States should come up with, guess what, a framework. And not come up with it, but sit down with the Israelis, try to get their agreement, talk with the Palestinians, talk with the other Arabs with whom have diplomatic relations with Israel, Jordan, and Egypt, talk with the Saudis, because the Saudis kind of represent the Arab peace plan, which includes all the Arab League, all the Arab League still have functioning governments. Some of them don't. Maybe work that out. Now, that's been tried before, and of course, then there was big time failure. And that would only conceivably work if there was a change in the government. But if that doesn't work, then Indyk said, go to the Security Council. And they get the five members of the Security Council to come up with a framework themselves. This isn't, a final deal. This is just what the parameters would be, what would happen in general to borders, what would happen in general for security, Jerusalem, and so forth. Now, as I said, that suggestion disappeared. But it's a huge departure, an enormous departure on the part of U.S. policy. Because if you listen carefully to what he said, the United States was not waiting to get Israel's agreement before they went to the Security Council. This would be kind of for the first time the United States getting real serious daylight between itself and Israel on this point. The days of Jerry Ford, there was a letter signed by Ford in which he said the United States would never make a proposal that had not been previously approved by Israel. So that all the time there are these negotiations, the U.S. Negotiator really was less of a broker than he was as an advocate. And that I think what Indyk is changing, proposing is a change in that.
Yeah, he went over, of course, the many, many difficulties in the entire peace process, and there's no question about it. The United States have made, perhaps will continue to make many mistakes. Whether or not the United States should have come up with some kind of a framework for peace, I think it could have, it should have, but that did not happen. But let me just bring back the discussion to Jerusalem itself, because we all agree, I think, that Jerusalem is one of the main obstacles, right? And we all agree that there is all of these issues between the two sides, major, like we talked about the distrust, the confidence, and all of this. But again, how do we change the dynamics if we all agree that there will be no peace unless Jerusalem becomes a state, a capital of two states? What is going to take to change the dynamic in order to get the public to understand that this is the only way we can go if we want to ever end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
I agree with the rabbi that if you don't build trust between the two communities, you're not going to go anywhere. I revert to my original idea that the place to start is in the legal system. Where you, if you can develop trust in the legal system, where if a Palestinian whose property is being taken away for a settlement can go to a court and with reasonable confidence that he will prevail in court, I think there will be a sea change in attitudes. Beyond that, politically, I'm always enamored of the idea of an imposed settlement from the outside, but I've got to be a realist, that is not going to happen in my lifetime. But again, if you do not have an element of trust and confidence between the communities, you're not going to go anywhere.
You know, I want to give it to you back in a moment. You know, the Israeli Supreme Court on a number of times took many decisions, actually, in favor of the Palestinians. And yes, many Palestinians cheered these decisions that favor the Palestinian position. But really nothing has changed. And when you talk about fundamental change in the justice system, and how this is going to go about, and how it's going to be filtering into the community at large, and is that really where it should begin? I mean, I'm not suggesting that should not happen. But would that be at the beginning? In fact, this is going to create a sea change that we need to create in order to move the two parties into something where they recognize that they must find some kind of a solution.
I'm afraid this is beyond my pay grade. What I do know that there has to be some leverage in any negotiation. I think nothing's happened because the United States didn't have sufficient leverage to move either side. I mean, I understand how obstinate and difficult the Israelis are to work with, but the Palestinians aren't so easy either. They did respond to the President and Kerry's offer. Warren and I were in a meeting with Mr. Indyk, actually, where he talked about that. So it's, you can blame both sides, or you can say, you know, both sides are difficult, you can go into the blame game. I don't think that's very useful. The question is, you know, what kind of leverage? I think it's really difficult for a Democratic president to put pressure on Israel, given the nature of the Democratic Party and its supporters. Maybe the sea change is now occurring here over this visit of the Prime Minister of Israel and the splits now in the Democratic Party over what's happening over that visit is in itself an interesting phenomenon, whether that will make a difference or not. I know people are much smarter than I about all these issues, so the most effective person, Secretary of State, dealing with this issue was Secretary of State Baker. It was a Republican president who wasn't beholden to a large Jewish community for political support, that was able to put some sufficient pressure on Israel. But that was already, you know, it's over 20 years ago. Whether there could be and Israel is much stronger now, economically much stronger than it was then. So I think the Palestinians are much weaker, and so that makes it that much harder, I think, to move it along. But as I said, I don't have any brilliant suggestions on the question that is so important.
You know, let me just go back to the initial where we started. The premise here that there is psychological dimensions to the religious conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Do we agree that there is this psychological dimension does exist, and how do we go about mitigating that? What is going to take? This is beyond just having justice. It's beyond sometimes what politicians would like to do or not to do. And I think it's also beyond another superpower like the United States to come in with a framework. There is, if we agree that there is a psychological or religious dimension to the conflict, don't you think we need to begin to address that? And how do you go about to address it, Jonathan?
I guess it's sort of, maybe this is a really naive thing to say, but I think if you know, theoretically, for like an Islamist, right, you would say, like, let's get someone from, you know, Islamic Jihad or something, come out. house these days. What does your religion tell you you have to do? Well, I have to, you know, I have to establish Islamic state here, and we have to have Sharia law, and you know, it will drive all the Jews into the sea, and yeah, okay, those are the things that, my religion is telling me. I don't know. This is just a guess. And if you said to him, okay, what if you just, we just call, you will now live in a state, one state, and everybody will have what right to vote, and constitutionally, you know, the rights of different religious groups and their kind of places of worship and you know, notions of religious propriety, these will all be enshrined, but otherwise people are equal, and they'll go about running this joint nation as everyone else in the world does, or at least in good functioning democracies. And you gave him that option. I would like to think, and maybe I'm dreaming, I would like to think that that person would take that option, because it's a lot better than this sort of completely unrealistic, ultimately horrendously destructive religious vision that he claims to have. And I think that that's maybe the, and that's not a religious vision. It's a political vision and a vision of sustainable life.
Well, you know, this is getting into very far-reaching kind of consequences about, you know, what does religion drive politics, or does politics drive religion? And I think I see ISIS and those extremists as using religion for their politics. And what's really driving them is anti-Westernism, anti-modernism, feelings of humiliation by the West, especially by the United States, and that's what's driving them, and that's what's driving, they're expressing that religiously, but it's really that, and that's really a tough one. I mean, how does the United States respond to that? You know, bombing just by itself, in and of itself, doesn't do much to address that kind of problem.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left, and I try to bring this to some kind of, can we maybe reach some kind of understanding in terms of where do we go from here? You know, we know that there is a conflict. To what extent do you feel, all of you, that the fact that the public, both Israelis and Palestinians, are not engaged in these discussions? If we agree that the public is not engaged in these discussions, what it is that we need to do? And if we agree also that it is critically important that the public need to be engaged in these discussions, what is going to take to get the public engaged in order to begin to change the dynamic? However slowly this might be, but is there really any other option given that if we, and I think I agree with you without any question, Jonathan, there are many religious, Jewish scholars, Muslim scholars, Christian scholars, if we were to sit down around table, they will agree, they will come to an agreement, this must be the solution, this is how it should look like. But how many people, in fact, know this possibility? Now, how do we promote that? How do we go about it so that we make the public beginning to be aware and engage the public in these discussions? Where else do we begin?
I don't know how to engage the public in a discussion on religious affairs. My experience has been that the public tends to be intimidated by religion, tends to be intimidated by men of the cloth in what they do. So there has to be a way of getting the men of the cloth actively engaged in politics. One of the comment that
they're engaged in politics.
Sorry?
They are engaged,
but engaged in they're engaged in politics. I stand corrected. But for example, a lot of these inter-religious conferences, patriarch no longer goes to them because he says the wrong people come to them. We have church leaders who go to the inter-religious conferences. If you don't have prime ministers and ministers of defense and heads of the military also actively participating in these conferences, their exercises in, you know, very pleasant exercises in academic futility. I don't see it coming.
I would just say you need a leader who has the trust of the majority of his population, who will take a great risk. We had two examples of that. Sadat went to Knesset, and Rabin took risks. both were assassinated. And that's the reality of the Middle East, is that what you need is that kind of leadership, both on the Palestinian side as well on the Israeli side. And of course, both are fraught with great risk because we've seen what's happened with other leaders when they've done that. But I think that's what you need, is that kind of leadership. It's not going to come from a religious leader, given just the nature of the culture in the Middle East. That is not going to do it. It has to be a political leader who has, though, credibility with his constituents. And unfortunately, we don't see many around like that.
Well, again, I think you can reconcile political differences. You can reconcile the claims of all kinds of sorts and sort. But how do you reconcile religious principles when religious, in fact,
but it isn't the fundamental issue.
Well, that's I respect your views on that. But there is, we all agree, however, there is religious components to this conflict. A religion does not require any kind of proof. I believe this is to be the case. As ISIS will tell you that, as Hamas will tell you that, as the Muslim Brotherhood will tell you that. Ask anyone who is really deeply, deep religious person with that kind of deep conviction will tell you, this is what I believe. I don't have to prove anything. This is my set of belief. Then you can reconcile communism, socialism, you can reconcile any set of political orientations. But here you have a religious component, and you have to begin to reconcile only because the reality itself demands that reconciliation. So yes, you could have a political leader who can in fact, I mean, Yitzhak Rabin attempted that. Ben Gurion himself from day one suggested, it's better to have part of the land with a Jewish state, democratic state, and all of the land without having a real state, a functioning state. And you have to be very sensitive toward the Palestinians. Yes, so political differences and conflicts can be resolved. I just want to back again, I'm going to bring it back only to this, because this is the purpose of this discussion, of this panel. It's the religious issue here. And a religious man with that kind of conviction, what kind of advice you want to give that person to tell him, this is a reality, you need to reconcile that with your religious conviction. And you can't tell me that there are no Muslim with that kind of religious conviction who feel Jerusalem belonged to them. And there are many Jews who tell you Jerusalem belonged to them. And this is what we are struggling with. And what do you go? I mean, if we leave this open-ended, and we stated difficulties without any question, it's an extremely intractable issue. But are we prepared just to say, leave it because it's very difficult? Or are we going to wait for that messiah, political leader, who's going to come and say, well, guys, we have to change our views on this matter. So let's just start to conclude this discussion. Your take on it.
I think that the issue is if you live in a functioning pluralistic democracy, you can have whatever religious belief you want. It doesn't mean you get to take something from somebody else. And this is the fundamental thing, right? I mean, the problem is that the Israeli political creature, the Israeli political establishment, has not told Jews in Israel that they are not allowed to take stuff that doesn't belong to them. And that is, I think, a fundamental problem. And yes, Palestinians are not allowed to take the lives of innocent people, right? But I mean, you have, just to look at the Israelis, because the Israeli side is actually theoretically possible for them to do something about it. If you can tell people that your religious belief does not give you the right to take the possession of someone else, okay, then if that were established, I think that would completely change the reality 180 degrees.
I'm sorry, I keep sliding off in politics here. The election campaign in Israel right now, these issues are not being discussed. Very little is being discussed about Jerusalem, about West Bank, about negotiation, non-negotiation, Palestinian. It's mostly about domestic issues. Why is that? It's because they're too hot. It's because no politician really wants to run on one of these issues. But I think after the elections, after March 17th, there's going to be a new coalition government. I think you can see initiatives coming out of the United States, this administration's got 18 months to go, they're going to try to do something. The Palestinians are going to want to push, they've been pushing on the International Criminal Court. That's going to start warming up again in April or May. And Israel's going to need to respond. So I think this spring, we may see quite a bit of action.
It is very tempting to wait for the Messiah. Absent real political leadership, which at the moment I don't see anyone qualified to provide out of any of the parties, absent real political leadership, it's either wait for the Messiah or see how outside parties can affect it.
Jonathan said it very well, and of course, many Jews feel that they didn't steal anything. It's theirs, right? It's been ours. And part of it is grounded in the Torah, and part of it is grounded in Jewish nationalistic view of Jewish history. But at the same time, from a religious point of view, many of great Torah scholars have said that the Torah was given to the Jewish people in order to create peace in the world. And so from a religious point of view, it's very possible to make those concessions based on that ideology. But again, and that's why I come back to say that it's not so much the religion that's getting in the way. One can find religious justifications to come to negotiate and to compromise over the land and who owns what. But it's more the sense, this national sense on both sides that it's theirs, right? Palestinians believe it's theirs and it was taken from them. And many Jewish people believe that it's been ours since ancient times. And so that's kind of the nub of it.
Yeah.